Hey, folks, we've got a great interview coming up right now with Barry Ritholtz. We're recording this on Wednesday, the 9th. And I'm putting this little disclaimer in front of this show because we're talking about the economy as it exists on Wednesday, the 9th of the year of our Lord, 2025. God knows what's going to happen between now and the time this podcast comes out, either on Thursday or Tuesday. Thanks. I know you're going to enjoy this one. He's so smart.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I am joined today by the brilliant Barry Ritholtz. He hosts the Masters in Business podcast. He is a writer for Bloomberg. He is a financial genius. He is a guy who understands money and markets like very few others. And I'm delighted to welcome him today because right now we are in a moment where understanding what the markets do and what they're about to do is more important than ever. And you're hearing a lot of loud noises and a lot of drama because there is a lot of drama and loud noises right now based on this trade war. So I wanted to start out, Barry, by just first thanking you for coming on the show, and then ask you, you said before, let the data speak for itself. Talk to us about the data that is being generated so far from this trade war. What do we know about the impact of this trade war so far?
Sure. So we often break the world of market and economic data into two kind of piles. Some are called soft data and some are called hard data. Soft data are when we do surveys, when we take sentiment readings, when we ask people, what are your intentions in the future? That's soft data. And since, you know, for about the past month and a half, the soft data has started to turn a little negative. Consumer sentiment has been negative for a few years, really going back to before the pandemic. There have been all sorts of analyses trying to figure out why. It kind of has a partisan overlay. But when we speak to people about how available are jobs? What do you think your travel plans are going to be in the future? How satisfied are you with the state of the economy? That's taken a turn down, as have surveys of corporate executives. What are your plans for CapEx, meaning capital expenditures, making investments, building plants, hiring? And that's turned soft. Now, throughout the history of soft data, it kind of goes up and down. You know, we watch it swing, and sometimes soft data just kind of is noisy and it goes back to having no impact. But sometimes people begin to act on what they say their sentiment is, and it starts to show up in the hard data. And we see some examples of that in some recent corporate earnings. So Delta, one of the biggest airlines in the United States, they did a profit warning saying, we're seeing a reduction in trip planning and bookings. And when people start to get nervous about, am I going to have a job in 6 months? Hey, maybe this year isn't the best year to book a week in Disneyland. Let's hold off on planning a vacation. And so I'm not a big believer that you can talk yourself into a recession, but the combination of the tariffs and people becoming really nervous, we saw it in FedEx, another company, big shipping company, very often business to consumer, and they're warning they're seeing a slowdown. So people are buying less stuff online. Atlanta Fed does a GDP Now where they just take a snapshot of the economy every day, and the numbers have turned negative. So it takes more than just a quarter of negative data to cause a recession, but we're seeing lots and lots of signs that things are becoming dicey. Two good examples from the market. One is oil prices. People think, hey, isn't it great when the price of oil goes lower and you could tank up, fill up your car for $25? But what you're actually seeing when we see oil prices, when we see any market prices, that is a bet, that is a probability bet on the future. And people are saying, hey, there's going to be less travel, there's going to be less trade, there's going to be less manufacturing. There'll be less of a need for oil, and the demand goes down, the price goes down. So plenty of data warning signs that a recession is increasingly possible. In the beginning of the year, I said 10% chance of recession. Now that's somewhere between 40 and 50%. And as this continues, the possibility of a mild recession ticks up from practically zero to, hey, coin flip. And the possibility of a serious recession is also rising. It's still under 50%, but it's higher than it was before January 20th.
You know, I'm watching a lot of folks who just before Trump was inaugurated were praising all the animal spirits are back, market's going to explode, we're in the best capitalist age in American history. And I'm seeing, you know, Stanley Druckenmiller and Bill Ackman and Ray Diallo and Jim Milstein and all these other folks who suddenly are acting shocked that Trump isn't bluffing about the trade war. He's stuck to his gun so far on it. And I did they all think, I mean, and frankly, even Jamie Dimon seemed to believe earlier in the year that the trade war was a negotiating tactic. And now that the damage of this is starting to show, and now that the extent and, in my opinion, irrationality of it is starting to show, it seems like there's a little bit of the beginnings of a herd animal panic about how long this show is going to go on, how, you know, what's going to stop it. So far, nothing has.
So let me unpack that into three distinct little things, and I'll try and keep each short. The first is, you know, there's a lot of partisan jostling, and very often economics is used as a cudgel in partisan politics. So we heard all sorts of negative things about Obama. The market did great under him. We heard all sorts of negative things about Trump. One, believe it or not, the market did great under him. Same thing with Biden. All sorts of negative things. The market did great. It's almost as if the U.S. is a fast-growing, robust economy that is almost insulated from all but the worst impacts of presidential eras. And we've had a great run in the markets for the past 15 years. That includes the entire post-financial crisis year. That includes the pandemic year.
Sure.
That includes 2022, the first time we've had stocks and bonds both down double digits since 1981. Let's hold the general partisan braying aside for a moment.
Yeah.
When Trump was elected, there was a legitimate sense that, hey, we're going to get more tax cuts. The markets love tax cuts. Mm-hmm. We're going to get deregulation. And for better or worse, we'll ignore the fact that radical deregulation was a key factor, not the sole cause, but a key factor in the great financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have a more business-friendly environment. The FTC won't be busting our chops.
Right.
There'll SEC's be more mergers. There'll be more stock buybacks. You know, it always cracks me up. The last scene in Caddyshack, he got elected. It was like Rodney saying, hey, everybody, we're going to get laid. That's what it felt like that moment, like party time. Right. And there was a lot of truth to the sentiment that, all right, we are unleashing some animal spirits. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a number of people used to say, take Trump seriously, not literally.
Right.
But it turned out we should have taken him literally, not seriously. He's been a fan of tariffs his whole adult life. He calls himself Tariff Man. He says tariffs are the most beautiful word in the dictionary.
I always say tariffs is the most beautiful word to me in the dictionary.
And the reason none of the masters of the universe believed him, and it certainly, you'll read the headlines today, you see a lot of buyer's remorse amongst that class. Nobody believed them because the entire universe of strategists, economists, policymakers all know tariffs are a terrible idea from the 1800s. And the last time we put substantial tariffs into effect, it made the Depression worse in 1930. So nobody took it really literally because, you know, he had to go find like a third tier backwater economist in the guise of Peter Navarro that believed what he believed, because nobody who's actually witnessed this or thought this through thinks massive tariff increases is a good idea. Like, look, Vietnam is my favorite example. Mm-hmm. It's 100 million people. It's about $8,000 per capita income each year. The only way we reduce our trade deficit with them is if every man, woman, and child in Vietnam buys three Ford 150 pickup trucks. I don't really think that's going to happen.
Not in the cards. So a lot of the art or the vast bulk of our international trade, you know, we have one pool of it is our allies, Europe primarily, and the large pool, the 800 pound gorilla, is China. And right now, Donald Trump has set himself up with these 104% tariffs to play chicken with the Chinese. Now, as a friend of mine pointed out this morning, you know, China's in a recession they don't want to talk about. They're the only way, if they give on this trade war, it's going to cause massive unemployment in China, which Xi will not tolerate and cannot survive, most likely. Who do you see, how do you see the Chinese government playing this out? Because it strikes me that we're putting them in a very dangerous corner where they're going to have to do something external to the economic fight if this starts going off the rails.
So last time, we could look at what happened in Trump 1. Mm-hmm. They were very targeted to deep red districts.
Yep.
They stopped buying certain types of farm goods and agricultural products. Yeah. And like very much aimed at the heart of Trump supporters. They're already, the administration is already floating another $12 billion farm aid package. Kind of makes the idea that tariffs reduce the deficits sort of belies that, because, hey, if we just have to give these people $12 billion to offset the loss of exports, doesn't really seem to work. There's two big concerns I have. I have no idea what the hell China's going to do. I'm not a geopolitical expert. I pay attention to what's going on, but I certainly have no special insight.
Sure.
But I can tell you what concerns me. One is the realignment of the geopolitical order. So rather than every country having a one-on-one negotiation with the United States, suddenly there's a Pacific Rim alliance and they negotiate as a group. And suddenly the EU negotiates as a group in South America. And so being the biggest guy on the block that gives you an negotiating advantage is great until all the little kids you kicked suddenly gang up together.
Right.
So that's number one. And then second, you know, we're seeing sort of a buyer strike when it comes to treasuries. When stocks sell off, usually bonds go up and then rates come down. And when you're seeing stocks selling off and bonds selling off at the same time, it tells you there are a lot of foreign buyers that aren't participating in our treasury auctions. Number one, and number what that means in plain English is it has been called the exorbitant privilege that the world reserve currency is the dollar. When you put that at risk, you are putting the standard of living for U.S. citizens at risk, and that's deeply concerning also. I kind of laid out three scenarios. I do a quarterly call for clients 4 times a year, and the one I just did basically said, here's our best case scenario, here's the middle scenario, here's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is this is negotiating tactic. Hey, Vietnam said they'll drop all their tariffs to zero. Once the dam breaks, all right, we'll get through this. It's just temporary. That's the best case scenario. The middle case is there's some realignment, there's some negotiations, somebody has to come up with a face-saving way for him to walk this back. And then we're all a little worse off, but it's not a bloodbath. And then the worst case scenario is the rest of the world realizes the post-World War II United States as a economic leader, as a military leader, as a political leader, can't be relied on, especially with this administration being sort of haphazard when it comes to trade agreements and tariffs. I mean, these tariffs upend a lot of previous trade agreements. And so, hey, we can't trust them to honor their contracts. Maybe we need to think about the future and downgrade the U.S. And maybe it's not the dollar. Maybe we need a basket of currency to do global trades. I doubt it's going to be a cryptocurrency. It's more likely to be some basket. And that not only lowers standard of living for the United States, it lowers standard of living for people around the world. If you look at what the post-war environment has been, it's seen global improvement. We've seen poverty reduced, sure, illiteracy reduced. Everybody is better off. Now, there's a second argument. For about 40 years after World War II, the middle class in the United States flourished. Everybody was happy. Some of the tax changes done under Reagan and Clinton have allowed income inequality and wealth inequality to widen back to the last seen in levels in 1920s. And so that's where the source of anger has come from. When you see traditionally, you know, middle of the road, Midwest states voting for a tariff plan like they did once they supported the president, it's telling you people are angry. And I think they're justifiably angry. But the best response for that isn't, let's burn it all down. The best response is, hey, maybe we need to figure out a better way to do this. Maybe the country shouldn't be held hostage by lobbyists. Maybe selling congressmen, putting up congressional seats for sale, and then putting up those elected representatives to whoever's going to give them the biggest campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. Maybe Citizens United was a really bad idea.
You know, I think you hit on something there that, you know, we have internal things that we could have focused on reforming in this country that would have addressed, I think, a lot of the problems of deindustrialization and the impacts that global trade had on working class American voters. But those things aren't sexy. They don't give you a big social media buzz. They don't give you a churn in the entire world order. One thing I just saw on my screen here that a friend just sent me, he said the 10-year note is now up 60 basis points in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, that's a big increase. Like the Fed typically raises or lowers rates 25 basis points or 50 basis points, and they meet like 8 times a year. So it's every, you know, 6 weeks or so. So that's a really substantial move. And it's telling you, normally when people sell stocks, they roll into bonds. So stocks go down, bonds go up. When you're seeing what's happening on the bond side, like to me, having a buyer strike from foreign owners, it's not just China, it's Japan, it's Europe, it's the rest of the world puts its cash in U.S. treasuries. By the way, that's the great irony of the trade deficit issue. Wait, we get to print paper and send it to people, it costs us nothing, and they send us cars and furniture and computers and clothes and phones and all these great things. Oh my God, that's a fantastic deal for us, because what are they going to do
with
the
paper? Woods really worked out for us.
Yeah, so they're going to have to send the paper back to us to cash it in, and we'll just do it again. And there's a fundamental misunderstanding that, you know, someone else said, I have a trade deficit with my local supermarket. I buy a lot more from them than they buy from me, but I get food and I get to give them.
Food.
Yeah, that's right. So it's the whole underlying concept is really perplexing. And there has been this enormous failure of imagination amongst the Wall Street class, as well as the billionaire class, that is he really going to do this? No, this is, we have it too good as a country. And as they pick a wealth class, top 10%, top 1%, top 0.01%, he's not going to mess with that. Is that? That's why we wanted him to release the animal spirits, not cause the worst 2-day market crash since the 1950s. But that's what last Thursday and Friday was. It's very perplexing to a lot of people that the president is pretty much doing exactly what he said he was going to do for 40 years. It's just so radical and self-destructive that none of us, myself included, none of us thought, oh no, he's That's just him. This is a negotiating tactic. Nobody could be this, you know, self-destructive. And yet here we are.
But I mean, it, like, so if we're up 60 basis points, I'm no economist, but doesn't that mean we're going to end up with higher mortgage rates, higher lending rates here in, internally that is going to, that's going to zap American buying power? We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
Right. He's been pressing the Federal Reserve to lower rates. He's a real estate guy and he understands rates drive everything. Mm-hmm. We have this really weird situation. We're still dealing with the after effects of the financial crisis. So heading into the financial crisis, we changed the rules for who we lend money to. It used to be we lend money to people based on the borrower's ability to service that debt. And for about 5 or 6 years, that changed and it became the lender's ability to sell it to a Wall Street securitizer who would slice and dice it, repackage it, sell it. Look, safest treasury is only a much better yield, a much better dividend.
The CDO crisis is all because of that decision. Right.
And following the financial crisis, everybody, we moved a few million people into homes that they couldn't afford. They never could have afforded under the best of circumstances. They wouldn't be able to maintain. A buddy, Josh Rosner, who's a credit analyst, said these were renters with the option to default. And so when all those people went back to being apartment dwellers, when we moved 2 or 3 people, when we had a few million foreclosures, well, suddenly there was an excess of housing. There was a limited availability of construction loans to build new houses. And over the next 10 years, we wildly underbuilt homes to keep up with, look, back then we were 305 million people. Now we're closer to 340 million people in the United States. So there's a shortage of housing, number one. Lots of people, everybody, homes, businesses, families, everybody but Uncle Sam took advantage of low rates and refinanced. So not only did we underbuild houses for a decade, but people have these golden handcuffs of these 4%, 3%, 2.75% mortgages. They can't move. They can't trade up to a larger house or a nicer neighborhood because the 6.5%, 7% mortgages.
Right. The cost of the money is 2 or 3 times.
Right. Just to do a lateral move is going to double your monthly expenses. It doesn't make any sense. And so correctly, President Trump has correctly assessed the economy will be better off if we can get rates down lower, if we can free up all this limited supply that's frozen with these golden handcuffs, these mortgages, and then the economy will continue to do what it's been doing very robustly. I don't believe this is 3D chess and this is a purposeful attempt to lower rates. I think that's just what he's been pressuring the Federal Reserve to do. And now the Federal Reserve is, hey, we wanted to do 2 or 3 rate cuts this year, but these tariffs are so inflationary, we're going to be hard-pressed to lower rates. We may even have to raise rates, and he'll not be happy about that.
And it, you know, the other thing, as you pointed out in an article the other day, what this tariff plan represents for American consumers is the biggest tax hike in their lives. It is not magical money that flows from overseas, y'all. It is a tax that you pay. And it strikes me that it's going to proportionally, you know, hit lower income consumers who spend more of their discretion or more of their disposable income on the essentials than upper income. Upper income folks are going to be fine. It just strikes me that the guy or the woman who goes to, you know, Target to go do school shopping for their kid is going to be paying vastly more for everything because most of that stuff in Target and Walmart comes in either as a direct import from China or the supply chain pieces that end up coming here and being assembled here are coming from China.
That's right. This is a little wishful thinking on my part. So let's just use the stock market sell-off Let me explain why that's going on and how consumers ultimately are going to feel that. So markets are called a future discounting mechanism, meaning when you buy the stock market today, you're paying for revenue and more importantly, profits a year in the future, times some sort of multiple, right? It's profits times, let's use PE ratio, but you can use anything. And that's how you end up with stock price. And what you're seeing since April 2nd is the market saying, oh, we have wildly overestimated what the revenue and profits for corporate America are going to be. These tariffs that are going to make cars anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 more expensive, going to make household goods more expensive, anywhere from 10 to 20% more expensive, that some estimates I've seen are $2,000, $6,000, $8,000 per household. So if you're spending more on a basket of goods, it means you have that much less discretionary money to spend on a new car or a washing machine or a vacation. So basically, the market is saying, lower your expectations for economic activity over the next 12 months. It's not just oil. It's stock prices are saying, hey, either we're going to have at the very least, we're going to have a reduction of growth. So if we were growing 2.5%, 3%, 3.5%, and now we're growing 0.5%, 1%,
right,
in a $28 trillion economy, that's an amazing amount of lost consumption and activity. Yeah. But just in plain English, if we're paying more for basics, if we're paying more for everything we consume, well, it means overall the consumer is going to consume less, and that could very easily lead to a recession. And that's what the market is telling us.
One of the predicates underneath the tariff idea was that America was going to rapidly reindustrialize, and we were going to build factories to do all the things that Vietnam and China and the Philippines and Indonesia and all these overseas markets do in their countries. And one of the things that again, not an economist, but I do know that markets like certainty. Talk to me about how little certainty there is in the idea of companies going out and dumping a huge bunch of capital expenditure to build a new factory. I had an article this morning that was sent to me that domestic factory plans called off as tariffs drive up manufacturing and construction costs.
Right.
I mean, most people aren't going to say, okay, I'm going to build a factory in Ohio to build toilet seats that are currently stamped out in China for 99 cents a piece. I'm not going to spend $1 billion to build that factory if Trump could change his mind in 5 minutes.
Right. So certainty is the wrong word. The word I prefer is clarity, right?
Okay, got it.
Because the future is always inherently uncertain.
Okay,
and
got it.
Each year, there's always this giant surprise. Nobody was forecasting the pandemic or the Israel-Hamas war or the invasion, Russian invasion of Ukraine, or, you know, all these different things happen every year. And so the world is always somewhat uncertain. But usually we have some degree of clarity about the state of the economy and what government policies are coming into effect. So if I want to build a factory in Ohio, I need to have an idea of what my costs are going to be, what it's going to cost to actually put that up, what the tax costs are going to be, and just a whole bunch of related issues. It's what the cost of capital is going to be for that, what else I could use my capital for. And when you sort of upend the entire system, and this is what I was saying earlier, we began with soft data becomes hard data. When we do the New York Fed does a survey of CFOs, what are your plans for hiring? What are your plans for capital expenditures, CapEx? What are your plans for building plants and factories and offices? And when people start to say, we're just going to put a pin in it, we're just going to pause for a moment until there's a little more clarity because we have no idea what the hell's going on out there, we're now in the process of seeing that lack of clarity leading people to say, hey, here's and by the way, most of these things are multi-year. You know, you don't snap your finger and there's a semiconductor plant there. Just look at how long it took to reopen the semiconductor plants after the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So this is like a 3-4-5 year process. And the thought is, hey, we're going to wait a year or two till, or at least until some of this smoke clears, so we know what our needs are, what we're doing, what our clients are asking for. By making things so uncertain and by so radically upending the existing order, right now everybody's kind of frozen in place, where everybody is in a wait and see mode. And if wait and see goes on long enough, that slides into a very mild recession. So, mm-hmm. yeah, the lack of clarity is deeply problematic. You know, the fascinating thing is, in the old days, when the Federal Reserve would raise or lower interest rates, you'd find out about it by seeing what the bond market did. In the old days, I mean like the 70s and 80s. Now the Fed is very, very transparent. They're very communicative. Here's what we're seeing. Here's the data we're relying on. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what we just did. Okay, here's a press conference if you have any. So the markets are very used to not being surprised. Hey, mm-hmm. there's this mm-hmm. transparent process. We're anticipating what's going to happen. And these things all work themselves out pretty easily. This, you know, Liberation Day, this April 2nd, was none of that.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show.
This is one of the most important days, in my opinion, American history. It's our Declaration of Economic Independence. My fellow Americans, this is Liberation Day. April 2nd, 2025 will forever be remembered as the day American industry was reborn, the day America's destiny was reclaimed, and the day that we began to make America wealthy again.
The rationale underlying it was not made clear. The process was opaque. A number of people figured out that the formula that was used to determine tariffs came from ChatGPT. Like the whole thing is sort of ham-fisted and you know, you can't just Bigfoot your way into the market, you know, run around with your hair on fire and then leave and let other people have to clean it up. But that's kind of what happened. And that's why we're seeing not just this lack of clarity, but the rising expectations of an economic slowdown or a recession.
You know, you pointed out there's always an externality. There's always some surprise factor that hits. COVID, a war, you know, a famine somewhere, some disruption. But I think it's rare that the externality is sitting in the Oval Office. I think that's what I think that may be what's happening, what's causing a bigger impact on this, because it is he is mercurial and he is basing all this on a obscure, dead end part of economic theory that no one else believes. In this country, there's not a huge pro-tariff model out there, or people would have tried it before.
Well, we have tried it before. Didn't yeah. work well.
Well, so I mean, before I think, in our era, right?
I think you're putting your finger on it, is that we just haven't seen a self goal like this
right.
ever before. It's
ever.
You know, he has been incredibly fortunate as a political candidate that in 2016, when he was elected, he inherited an economy that was already well into the recovery process following the financial crisis.
Sure.
And then in 2024, you know, as much as there were a lot of political problems with the Biden administration and questions about did the public really know Kamala Harris well enough to right. elect her. She didn't go through the normal primary process. There's a lot of postmortems going on that side of the aisle.
Sure, rightly.
But at the very least, he inherited a robust economy. We had unemployment at 50-year lows. We had the stock market sure making all-time highs. GDP was robust. Consumer spending was robust. Yes, there were lots of problems that needed to be addressed. But the balance of trade and tariffs really weren't any of those things, and they don't seem to be targeted at fixing those problems. Tariffs are not going to reduce income inequality or wealth inequality. They're only going to make it worse. And here's the big news flash. If we bring all these manufacturing plants and factories mm-hmm. back to the United States, I got bad news for you. They're going to be automated and robotic. You're not hiring millions of people right. to make furniture or socks or you know, textiles. Those jobs are gone, and we don't want those jobs. They're low-paying jobs that you lose a furniture mill and you replace it with a sophisticated AI data center and software jobs and things like that. That isn't what this is going to fix. It's the whole thing is really you're starting to see frustration from a lot of people in Wall Street because they understand, hey, when we're investing in all these robotic companies and these software companies and these AI companies, we're not creating factory jobs. No one's going to be working on the line in these Correct. New factories that go up.
Yeah, I think, look, we have to be realistic about the future of work in this country. And we're not going, whoever it was that said the other day, Americans are going to be screwing in little screws into iPhones. That's not going to happen. That is, even if this whole tariff thing was some masterstroke to reindustrialize America, a machine will be putting those little screws into that iPhone. It's not going to be a guy who's making $35 an hour with full healthcare benefits and all that. That's just not how this is going to work.
The jobs of the future are designing those machines, building the software to operate it, mm-hmm. figuring out how to most efficiently and productively build that. And we've been doing that. We're one of the world leaders, if not the leader, in software and artificial intelligence and semiconductor design. When you look at NVIDIA, they don't actually build the chips. They mostly design the chips. That's right. The highest end work that you're going to do in terms of that whole supply chain. And so, mm-hmm. yes, there are lots and lots of problems in the United States that need addressing. I don't think anybody else really believes this is going to fix that.
I think that's right. Well, Barry Ritholtz, thank you again, sir, for coming on the show today. Barry's got a great new book called How Not to Invest. You should read it, especially right now. It's a moment where I think a lot of people will make a lot of mistakes in the market, especially retail level investors. A lot of people are at a higher level of sophistication are making mistakes because they think Trump is going to do something rational when he's going to do something probably not rational. But Barry, thank you so much for making all this much clearer for our audience. I appreciate it as always. Tell folks where they can find you on social media and podcasting.
Sure. So on Twitter or Blue Sky at Ritholtz, the book, HowNotToInvestBook.com, and the podcast is Masters in Business. You can find that at Ritholtz.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Bloomberg, YouTube, pretty much everywhere.
Fantastic. Well, Barry, thank you so much again, brother. I appreciate you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Rick. Really appreciate being here.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Produced by Whitney Hayes. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.